The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Today, we're talking to Norm Leach, Executive Director of the Vancouver Aboriginal Community Policing Center, about what it means to have a respectful relationship between police and Vancouver's Indigenous community. We reached Norm on the phone. Norm, so this idea of seeking better relationships with the police, can you start off by telling us a little bit about the VACPC's relationship with the VPD?
Vancouver has a number of community policing centers, I think 11 now, and generally they're neighborhood based. So they serve a specific neighborhood and they build relationships between the VPD and those neighborhoods. And then they work on basically community and public safety issues and engage the citizens in those neighborhoods. We're not neighborhood-based. We serve the urban Indigenous community, which is somewhere between 50 and 70,000 Indigenous people living in the Vancouver area. And they're everywhere. And most of them aren't from here. So our job is to, well, our mandate is to address the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the criminal justice system. And then one of the other big ones is to try to improve relations between Indigenous people and law enforcement, which is a huge challenge because of the history. The history of colonization has meant that, we were here first and all the laws came later. And most of the laws are built on a system that presumes and is premised on the idea that, you know, the settler or colonial culture is superior, is better, and needs to overrule all the laws and practices and traditions that Indigenous people use successfully for thousands of years. And that's never been reconciled. Like those differences, that clash of cultures has never been reconciled, which has led to a lot of discussion about reconciliation, which we're not convinced is possible even. So we're funded by the VPD to help improve the relationship. And ultimately, it's the city that funds both the VPD and us. So we have a relationship with the police department, and generally, it's a pretty good relationship. But again, so we walk the middle ground, the fine line between the Indigenous community and serving the needs of the Indigenous community and helping the VPD with their, you know, their public relations challenges when it comes to the Indigenous community. So we have to stay sort of in the middle and try to hold, you know, the police accountable when we can and try and show them and tell them how they can do things better, because too often it ends up being worse rather than better. So, you know, that's roughly the work, you know, our goal, our mandate. And then we were involved in many on the ground issues and activities. So from, you know, the overdose fentanyl crisis to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, to homelessness, to general poverty, to, well, the COVID-19, now tent cities, and protest marches, various other things. So we operate some street outreach in the downtown east side. We operate a youth art studio space at Kiefer and Gore in the BC Artscape space. And then we just engage with many, many community partners like the Aboriginal Front Door and WARS and downtown, the grandmothers, Circle of Grandmothers of the downtown east side.
Maybe let's start with just your description of how you see, let's just get it from you. How would you describe the relationship between Indigenous folks and the Indigenous community broadly and the VPD now?
Well, it's been worse, especially, you know, in the aftermath of the Robert Picton trial. And the inquiry that followed that, the Wally Opal inquiry, and the report, Forsaken, basically highlighted all the failures and challenges that not only VPD, but all the other police agencies in the Lower Mainland have with not only Indigenous people, but, you know, sex workers, drug users, roughly all the marginalized communities that are poor and have very little power. So yeah, it's been worse. The VPD really was called on the carpet from that report and that process. And they've made some significant changes. We have a really good relationship with Chief Palmer and, you know, his team of his management team. And for the largest part with officers on the street. Saying that, you know, there is still systemic racism in every system and institution in this country. To deny that is, to me, absurd. It's to lose credibility, to simply out and out deny it. It's not reasonable to deny that systemic racism is built into the system. Simply the fact that all the laws are written in English. All the laws were written by not us. None of the laws reflect our worldview or our, you know, 15, 20,000 year history occupying and taking care of these lands. So to presume that an introduced and colonized and imposed system would not be premised on and built on foundations of racism is absurd. So as much as our relationship, our working relationship with law enforcement and VPD is you know, respectful and reciprocal, it still does not reflect an indigenous approach or understanding of what it means to be a good human being or what it means to be a citizen of this land. It's a work in progress, always. Roughly to indigenize the system is a monumental task, and it's going to take quite a while. So we approach it, you know, basically one person at a time. One officer at a time, one citizen at a time, one mayor and council at a time. Yeah, it's never going to be, I think, complete or finished. So the relationship is, yeah, it's a work in progress, and we still feel it's worthwhile to engage in the process.
Norm, would you be able to spend a little bit of energy and explain to a settler like me about the systemic racism within our laws? You talked about just here in the conversation and in the letter about how the legal system was created by colonizers, by white men who don't share, haven't been here for 15, 20,000 years. And I think for people, for settlers like me, I think I can understand residential school and that being a horrible example of colonialization. I can understand having lands taken away and being sold at very low prices to white sellers and having indigenous people pushed off the land. That's very obvious example of systemic racism in our systems. But when I talk to my friends now, many of them will say, but wasn't that in the past? Can you sort of explain to people, settlers like me, how that still carries forward in modern day laws?
Well, the legal system of laws in Canada, like most systems around the world, right, were imposed by people who came later. So, you know, especially almost every human on the planet in their family history has colonization in their family history, right? They have those traumas too. Like, you know, your ancestors may have been colonized by someone else. And so human history is full of colonization. We just happen to be some of the most recent, right? So where I'm from, Lillooet, the first explorer was Simon Fraser, and that was only 1808, right? That's barely 200 years ago. So for BC, we're still adjusting. But for other parts of the world, whether it's Africa or Asia or even parts of Europe, they were, you know, that colonization process began 1,000 years ago or more. So it's been going on since the beginning. So and that trauma has affected your family history as well. And then what we understand now is that trauma can be passed down through generations. It's intergenerational trauma. And so you have also inherited some intergenerational trauma due to colonization. It's not just us. So if we examine what the way of life that was before colonization, it's not that long ago for us, then we can understand that there are certain things that seem prevalent in modern society that we didn't have. We didn't have patriarchy. We didn't have huge imbalances in wealth. We did not have systemic and accepted levels of violence towards women. You know, our communities were safe for women. And I don't know that there's a society in place anywhere in the world now that where they can reasonably say that, yes, it's safe for women here. It was in our communities. So there are many aspects of colonization that are just unhealthy. And we know that there was a better way because we had it. And so if we want to talk about indigenization, we know that it worked successfully for thousands of years without democracy. In fact, we didn't have democracy. We had other ways, and that reflected the balance between men and women. But not only the balance between men and women and humans, but also the balance between humans and the world around us and nature. We didn't view everything as property. We had relationships with everything, with the mountain, with the river, with the ocean. That's a relationship that has to be respected. And we understood that the land, we came from the land, all of us came from the land, and the land is our first ancestor. And we share that ancestor with everyone, with everything. And so we treat her like an ancestor, further back than mother. Our first grandmother is the land. And she taught us everything, and she gave us everything, and she still does, and she never stopped. So we know that she loves us, and she loves all of us, except we knew that it was our job to pay that back as much as we could, knowing that we really couldn't, because we're nothing without her. Except it seems like a lot of humans forgot that. And so that they treat her like property. They treat her like a thing, something to be owned and exploited and harmed. And we don't understand that. Now, we also understand that it's been very difficult for us to explain this to other people. Well, because first of all, we're not using our original language. And we never had to explain it to anyone before. It was just understood. We just assumed that everyone knew these things, so we never had to develop to explain it. It was just so built into everything. So that's kind of what I've been working on lately, is trying to develop that way of explaining it and exploring conversations with settlers and other people to understand what the differences are, so that I can understand it, so that, you know, maybe we can, through dialogue, come to that understanding of what we're talking about. Because so many people, it's just a confusing topic about colonization and reconciliation and what are the differences and what does it mean, especially in practical terms. Like, you know, all we see is the hashtags, land back, decolonize, defund the police. There's not a lot of meaningful discussion about, okay, well, what does that really mean to you and I? And how are people proposing that that's going to occur? The discussion needs to expand and broaden and include ultimately everybody. You know, right now we're just doing it one at a time.
Norm, there was a good amount of information, and as I think about trying to make this more concrete for my listeners too, who maybe don't spend a lot of time thinking about reconciliation and what that means, I'm trying to understand how the legal system could have looked different if it was created not by colonizers, but by people living in the land. I think you started talking a little bit about property rights and how even that would look different or not exist. Could you sort of tell us a little more about that, about how it could look different?
Right. So there's key differences between the indigenous worldview and the colonized. So we're much more about relationships than property. Ownership is a kind of a relationship which really doesn't respect the property, right? It elevates humans up above everything else. Actually, it elevates human men above everything else. Even in, you know, the roots of law had women were property, children were property of men. So in that system, whoever writes the law tends to write it in a way that benefits them. So we didn't write down laws. We didn't have written language, right? So our understanding is that the land taught us everything, right? The law, the land imposes its fundamental laws on everything. So the law of the Arctic says that, you know, these are the things you need to do to survive. And ignoring that law will mean you die. The law of the desert is different from the law of the Arctic. And the law of the west coast of BC is pretty forgiving and generous, simply because there's food and resources everywhere. But each land imposes its own fundamental law. So what we did was we interpreted, we learned those laws, and we adapted them, and we, in a way that allowed us to succeed and prosper and live successfully. So we understood. But these other laws were imposed from somewhere else, and they tended to serve the interests of the people who wrote them down. And that none of that, we didn't do any of that, right? So all these laws were written by someone else and imposed on us. So that, and that probably resonates with anyone who has felt injustice from the system, that the system is not about justice, because it's a different definition of justice. So our definition of justice is more about healing and balance and harmony rather than crime and punishment. See, so that's an entirely different definition and view, a perspective on what is justice. And that vision of justice, you know, again, evolved from, well, the Judeo-Christian approach of a vengeful God who saw things as sin and penitence. And then that became crime and punishment. And then that shows up in colonized law in that way. And to us, that's not justice at all. There's no justice in that system. There's laws, and there tends to be winners and losers. And there's also crime and punishment. But it doesn't address healing. It doesn't address balance and harmony. And how can you have a justice system that ignores those things? So that's how we see that it's not entirely compatible. They certainly, they're not a good fit. And again, we're not sure they're reconcilable. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense. It's interesting. You're talking about, I didn't see this before you explained it to me. You're talking about completely different frameworks for legal systems.
Worldviews.
And so it wouldn't just look a little different. The legal system would look substantially different.
We'd have to go down even underneath the foundations of the system, right? Because the modern legal system is based on precedents, right? All modern decisions are based on older ones, which are based on older ones, which are based on older ones, which go all the way back, right, to you know, the Royal Proclamation of 1763 and the Magna Carta and all those underlying documents which, you know, underlie, and as I say, even the Bible. So they're based on all those things, and to deny that those things have bias and only reflect one worldview, well, again, that's absurd too. And none of those things reflect the indigenous worldview. And we know that our way worked better for 20,000 years.
Norm, I want to ask you about straddling the... You talked about now having a relationship with the VPD, and that exists within the system that you wouldn't have chosen, and many, all indigenous people wouldn't have chosen. Can you speak a little bit about that, about how it is that you, how you view carving this, creating this relationship with the police department in a system that you wouldn't have chosen?
Well, we have to address what's happening now, right? So right now we know that we are far overrepresented in prisons, right? So 40% of men in prison are Indigenous. 60% of women in prison in Canada are Indigenous. You know, that's, it's either obvious that we're born criminals or that the laws were written to conflict with us. And we know that we were here long before the laws were written. And we also understand that, you know, the RCMP or the Northwest Mounted Police was created to police the frontier, which is us. And it was there to protect settlers and their property from us. So, but nobody else sees that, right? Because it's not taught in schools. So, you know, and so it comes almost as a shock to new recruits that we speak to, and we speak to all new recruits out of the Police Academy at the Justice Institute, to understand the history a little bit, that, you know, that it was, that there were many laws in the past that were written that were completely unjust, like the law that you mentioned that, well, we, so first of all, I explained, we talk about residential schools and the horrible things that happened to children there. And then I explained that we know that these experiences exist in every single Indigenous family history in this country. Every single one. And the reason we know it's every single one is because it was the law. It wasn't optional. It wasn't. And so parents had to send their children to the exact same schools that they went to for years and years and years and years, generation after generation, knowing the things that happened there, knowing that the same people were there who had abused them, and they had to send their children one after another. And when, if they resisted, it was against the law. If they objected, it was against the law. If they tried to hide their children, it was against the law. And so when you did things that were against the law, well, they sent people there whose job it is to enforce the law. Now, we know now that those laws were not just, that those laws were harmful. And so those laws were repealed and they were apologized for and compensation was paid for enforcing those laws. How do we know which laws now might have to be apologized for 50 years from now? So those are some of the questions we pose to police officers, to new police officers, to understand that just because it's the law doesn't mean it's justice. And we ask you, you know, we ask you to be, you know, not only good police officers and law enforcement officers, but also be good human beings. And that's a big ask, but it does require, but isn't that required of all of us as human beings? Is what we're doing just? Is it fair? Is it, does it make sense? And really we're asking that question of all of colonial systems now.
Norm, I know the one of the roles the VACPC plays is creating a space where Indigenous people can feel comfortable reporting incidents that are harmful to their safety, sort of the way non-Indigenous people in society would be. If they see a crime, they pick up the phone, they call 911, they get the police over. Can you talk to us a little bit about how, about what an Indigenous person may or may not feel when seeing something? If, you know, they see a crime, they want to pick up the phone and report it. Do people feel comfortable doing that? What goes through people's minds?
Unfortunately, not at all. That's the call that they will avoid because, you know, the history has shown us that the police are not there to protect us, that the police are there to, well, historically take away our children. To enforce laws, to force us off of lands that our ancestors used for thousands of years, and to, you know, and to support the rights of someone else to do those things to what we've always considered our territories, our responsibility. Our sacred responsibility, our deal with the Creator who put us in our lands to use, protect, manage, and defend in a good way. You know, and that was in exchange for the many gifts that we received, right? That the land provided us with everything. And now we're told that we're not allowed to fulfill our responsibilities to those lands because someone else has written laws that say otherwise. And that's, yeah, we haven't accepted that, right? Because we're not given that option, right? It's a sacred responsibility to our land. It's a relationship. She's our ancestor. How do we simply walk away and say, I guess the law is the law. It wasn't our law. Our laws were in place thousands and thousands of years before that, and they would never allow these things to happen. So, so to explain those things in a way that they understand, so that they recognize that we know that they're not there to enforce our law, and they're not there to protect us. So, if anything, it's distrust, fear, suspicion, and unfortunately very often hatred. And that's the sense that Indigenous people have towards law enforcement, because that's the relationship that's been, we've been forced against each other. We've been forced into conflicting positions by the law, right? So we know that law enforcement officers don't write the law. They don't. You know, most people aren't aware of who it is sitting in those rooms writing those laws. We just know that they get imposed on us and that, you know, we get punished if we go against those laws. But most of us aren't involved in writing those laws. We just come out of somewhere, you know, either Victoria or Ottawa or maybe City Hall. But those laws, we don't know where they came from, and we weren't involved in writing them. But we've also learned that those laws serve the interests of someone, and usually the people who are most involved in writing them. Right? If you and I played a game of Monopoly, but I said, I'm going to write the rules, well, you could be pretty certain that I would win. Because I would write them, and maybe not explicitly, you know, in favor of my interests versus yours, but subtly, and I would, having written the law, would know my way around that law better than you. That's the system that we live in.
Norm, can you take me in the head off as best as you can, because you're probably not in that position, but say if I'm a female living in the downtown east side, I'm living in an SRO room with maybe a partner and someone else, and I know that my partner is beating me, and I know that's not right despite the dynamics. Our relationships are complicated, but all that, I know that that's not right, and I need help. And I know if I were a non-Indigenous Canadian, I'd pick the phone up and call 911. But if I were an Indigenous woman in that situation, what kind of thoughts could be going through my mind?
As that woman? Yeah, that it's not safe for her to phone the police because they might not take her side. They might, especially if her partner's non-Indigenous, if he's white, then... And she knows that she's in a much more difficult position, and she knows that there's not a lot of resources available for her to go to. You know, even so, similar to that, say that same woman did experience sexual violence, a sexual assault, maybe from her partner, maybe from a stranger, but we know. The data is clear. Fewer than 1 in 10 of of all women will report that assault because they know that the system is not going to be kind or gentle to them. And it's far lower for Indigenous women. Far fewer than 1 in 10 will report. And then we know of those reports, fewer than 1 in 10 of those reports will lead to charges. And we know that fewer than 1 in 10 of those charges will lead to conviction. So the system is not built to protect women in the first place, period. And we also know that the system is far less built and designed to protect Indigenous women. The Picton experience and trial and the national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls points that out and proves it, but the response tends to be, how do we respond better after it happens? How can the police respond better? How can the courts respond better? How can citizens respond better? Where in that discussion are we about, we just have to stop doing it? It's just wrong for women not to be safe in this world. When did it become acceptable for men to mistreat women? Not when we were, the only ones here, but it seems to be the one, what, one crime that seems to be acceptable around the world. All cultures, races, ethnicities, nations have seemed to have accepted that, well, we have to accept it, therefore we just have to find ways of responding better after it happens. But nobody is talking about just stopping it, preventing it, that changing the behavior. And we also know that the number one threat against women's safety is men. So I don't know. And to us, that's, the biggest and worst aspect of colonized ways, worldview, or the things that they're willing to accept as normal. To us, it's just insane. It doesn't make sense at all. So to that woman, we say, call us then. Because we understand the situation. We understand trauma. We also know that most police lack trauma training. We've really adopted a trauma-informed approach. We have training how to recognize trauma, how to respond better to trauma, and how to heal trauma. Because, again, trauma is infused in our experience. The last 500 years for us has been all trauma all the time. So we have to understand the effects and why it explains why we are the way we are right now. But we also know that there are ways to heal it, and we're using those ways. So we say call us and we will walk you through the system and we will stay with you through the process to find you the help that you need and to find you the healing that you need. And the police, that's not their job, right? They're not in the job of healing or even of really providing any of those trauma-informed or helping or social services. Their job is to enforce the law. And really, they're given a limited set of tools, right? They're given their understanding of physical violence and maybe weapons handling and the law. And so they use those tools. But they're not given trauma training. They're not given mental health training. They're not given all those other skills. So a lot has to change.
Norm, we're having such a good conversation, and I just want to respect your time because I know I asked you for 20-25 minutes and we're past that. I've got lots more that I'd like to ask you about, but I just want to check in about your time and whether you're able to keep talking.
I've got a few more minutes. We could maybe follow it up another time if you want to schedule another time too, if you want to get deeper into some of these subjects. But I've got a few more minutes, 10 more minutes.
Okay. Let's go with that and then maybe we'll schedule another time too. I'm curious, Norm, what that looks like. If, say, if I were that woman and I called the VACPC and I said, hey, how do I report this? What does that look like? How would the VACPC approach this differently from, say, a non-culturally sensitive organization might?
Well, again, so we take a very trauma-informed approach. We understand how she's in a position of confusion and indecision and even of self-blame. We understand how trauma does that to people. And we're very non-judgmental about any of that. So we don't insist that, well, you have to report. We will try to encourage her to report. We're not going to, you know, disclose, break her confidentiality. If she doesn't want to, then we have to respect that. We will find her other supports, safe, secure, secret housing that we can get her to. Other supports if there are children involved, other supports if, you know, maybe there's some substance use dependencies involved, and maybe even some, again, because trauma is classified as a mental health issue anyways. But we have access to all those resources and people who we trust. And so we can reassure them that, yes, these are trustworthy people. And we're not going to, you know, just hand them off to someone. We will stay with them through the process. Then we also have a police officer who's stationed with us. And, you know, we've sort of indoctrinated him into our way of doing things, right? And so he's agreeable to that, and he's able to use his discretion in a way that fits with, you know, building trust and relationship with the Indigenous community and citizens. So, you know, we will consult together on the approach to take, knowing that, you know, we would like to get it to reports and pressing charges and to do an investigation, but it has to be done in a, you know, in a trauma-informed way. So, again, her health and safety are first, and moving forward with healing the harms that have been done, as, you know, crimes have been committed, and also exploring other ways of holding people accountable for, you know, the harms that they've done on other people, you know, without forcing someone to go and testify in a court of law, right, which is so terrifying and you know, as I've said, not kind or gentle, especially to women who are reporting crimes of violence against them. And the system does not have a great track record, especially to Indigenous women or women of color or, you know, marginalized women. So we, again, as much as we can, we be on the side and beside the people who call us. That's the best way we know how.
Norm, I want to ask you a little bit about cultural awareness training for police, anti-bias training. I know you do some of that with new recruits through the VPD. I'm curious, what do you think? Do you think that works? For the staff coming out from U.S., many advocates say that it doesn't. Many advocates say, like, look at what in Minneapolis, police in Minneapolis receive a lot of anti-bias training. Didn't do George Floyd any good. What do you think?
Well, we've been involved in some decolonizing work just with regular citizens, new Canadians, immigrants, just regular neighborhood people, and realize that we're asking a lot of people to re-examine their fundamental underlying values and principles that basically they live their lives by right now, and to question them and to say, is it really true? Is democracy really the only way? Is the way we treat women just? and individually, maybe we could say yes, but man, society-wide, it's wow. It's there's a huge disconnect there. So we think that it can be. I think we're able to get them to a place in the 3 hours they give us. They give us 3 hours with each class. We would like 3 days. We think in 3 days we could create that shift so that people can understand that this system that we have is based on one worldview and one approach and one way of doing things that not only ignores, but it discounts and it actually devalues all the other possible ways, including indigenous ways. And so that is built into the system. And you can't fix it by fixing the top three layers without fixing the land underneath, the roots and the foundation and the premises and the assumptions that that system is based on. Oops. We have to believe that it's possible. one at a time. I don't know if I've shifted your perspective on indigenous ways and worldview and values and culture in this conversation. So if that's possible, then we have to think that it's possible for everybody. Because police officers and law enforcement, they're just people too.
In your experience, does that shift in the 3 hours that you're given, does that shift police perceptions significantly enough to make the lives of people better? So the reason why I'm asking is because there's this question now, this larger systemic question of, does anti-bias cultural awareness training work in general, or should we just really make a move to defund the police and shift funding away to other sources? Can this practice, should we invest more in anti-bias training, or should we just take that money and move it, and not just that money, but more funding and move it to other places? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's got to expand. It's got to start in childhood. It's got to start with re-examining what are the cultural values that we're all operating under, and does it really reflect, the Canadian vision of equity, of equality, of fairness, of justice, when we know that Canada and all colonized and colonial societies are built on premises and assumptions and foundations of racial supremacy. And as long as you can write the laws that give yourself permission to do things, that it's according to the law, and the built-in injustices in doing that, and then also the costs of those injustices, especially on the people that they're imposed on. So if humanity is ready to have the conversation about what is it going to mean to be a good human being in the next 1,000 years, and we need to start those conversations now, especially because it needs to include the relationship with the land that we live on, because we've disrespected this land. You know, it's only been 500 years, this experiment with this new way in Canada, and we have to say that we are long past calling this experiment a failure, that the destruction that has been wrought on our ancestor here is immense, and humans have so much to answer for what we've done to these lands that has caused such harm, not only to the lands, but to the people who live on it. And so we're open to start that conversation. You know, that's a big part of what I'm doing these days. But humans have to start reconsidering the way we're behaving, because it's not working. Like the past 500 years have not been The report card would be pretty bad.
And that was Norm Leach, Executive Director of the Vancouver Aboriginal Community Policing Centre, about what it means to have a respectful relationship between police and Vancouver's Indigenous community. And you're listening to The Pulse on CFRO, your independent daily news show, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Tan Mei Si. All right, enough talking. Take care and have a great start to your week.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.